You're listening to The Big Interview, first broadcast on the 26th of July, 2015, on Monocle 24.
Hello, I'm Robert Bounds, and this is The Big Interview, our one-on-one programme in which people with extraordinary lives and careers, and maybe even tall tales to tell, sit down and tell us what really happened, how they got here, and what makes them tick. Today, I'm talking to Ian Schrager, the hotelier and design aficionado who, without recourse to hyperbole, really has changed the face and the guts of the hotel world. You'll have heard of, maybe stayed in, the Gramercy Park Hotel, Morgan's, the Delano and the Shore Club in Miami, the Sanderson in London, or The Addition, a hotel brand growing faster than field mushrooms after summer rains. Now comes Public, a new hotel concept from Schrager, but one in the old iconoclast's image, style, but not quite like anyone else's. Hang on, didn't he start doing something else, I hear you ask? Well, of course he did. The small matter of co-founding with the dearly departed Steve Rubell, the most famous and infamous nightclub in history, Studio 54, haunt of legends, home of epic, eye-watering socialising and fun. Ian Schrager was born in New York City in 1946 and studies at Syracuse University and St. John's University School of Law, and he lives in New York City still. And why not? Because it's a pretty nice place. Thanks for having us in your hometown, Ian Schrager.
Thank you very much for having me.
Let's delve right in with New York City. It's, as we mentioned, all those storied successes you had starting off in your hometown. Can you put a figure on it, or can you put an adjective on it to describe just how much this city's changed since you opened that nightclub way back in 77?
We're completely different. Everything is completely different. Times change, people change, cars change, fashion changes, kitchen appliances change. It's just a totally different time and place. Back then, when we opened up Studio, I mean, when you try and connect the dots, this is when I think the sexual revolution had reached full mast. It was when New York City was bankrupt or on the verge of going bankrupt. It's almost as if the world tilted over and everybody from Europe rolled into New York and everybody from California rolled into New York. We couldn't go any further down. It was when the gay population was just beginning to set the cultural tone, and it was just a crazy, crazy time. I often heard my parents say that their time was most interesting.
Right.
I guess everyone thinks that previous times were most interesting, but it was just a really anything goes kind of feeling. There was an excitement in the air in New York. I mean, there were lots of nightclubs all over, and it was within that kind of era that Studio 54 happened to be the right kind of club in the right kind of place at the right time.
And can you, I mean, we'll go on to talk about your upcoming projects and the things you're involved in still, but can you see, is there DNA in, for example, we'll talk about Public, which is a new hotel concept from you. Can you see in something like Public the DNA of Studio 54 and what you started off? Is there a line that you can draw between all of your projects?
Of course there is. There's always, a bunch of connecting dots. It's just a question of someone connecting the dots. Every one of our projects start off with an idea. They're really not about design. People are skeptical when I tell them that. I mean, the design is a little bit like special effects in a movie. It can make a good movie better. It can't make a bad movie good. And I'm more a social scientist than a designer. And I kind of look at things that are in the air and what people are going, what direction they're going to. There is a collective unconsciousness. Hem heights raise and lower across continents for some reason, and I'm trying to tap into that zeitgeist. I try to do that in my first project, Studio 54, kind of hit it was where people were, what they were into. I try and do that now, and I think that now that people are very interested in getting good value for their money. It has nothing to do with an economic cycle. It's just that people are very, very aware of it, perhaps because wealth is so permeates so many people that are wealthy that it's just not as important as it once was. And so I think this notion of providing great style and an elevated experience, but making it accessible to a lot of people, not only rich people, is a really important idea. And it's a time where this idea, its time has come. And that's what public is all about, providing the same kind of luxury, but a different luxury, a more accessible luxury without the pretension. And at a good price.
I love that analogy you made of design being a little bit like the special effects in a movie. They can't make a crap movie good, you know? And if hotels are almost like the stage set that your nightclubs have been, is that one of your jobs as a hotelier, as a custodian of all the brands that sit under your umbrella? Is that your job to almost give people a stage on which to behave well or badly, but with some gusto and style?
Of course. You know, staying in a hotel is more than just giving a person a place to sleep. I mean, that kind of like takes the whole experience and makes it a kind of mundane existence. I think that when people go into a hotel, they want something exciting. They want an elevated experience. The paradox is they want to feel like they're at home. They want to feel comfortable, but they also want to experience something that they can't experience at home.
Yeah.
So it's trying to bridge that gap and trying to create the magic. And trying to create the magic with a hotel is a lot like trying to create the magic with a nightclub or a lot of other things. It's a kind of alchemy happens. It's not just the sum of all the parts. It's like a spark that happens when it gets all put together in the right way.
And I wondered about the idea of the perfect mix in a hotel. You know, I mean, certain hotels, I presume, they're tough to get into, not just about being expensive, but there's an exclusivity which goes far beyond how many dollars it costs a night to stay there. Studio 54 was notoriously difficult to get into, or you could be as poor as a church mouse, but you had to have the right look to get in, which is very nice. Is there an element of that in your hotels that you want to affect the best balance of people?
Well, yeah, yes, of course there is, but it's not done in a kind of very purposeful way. You know, there's a screening process, but it's a very natural screening process. We're appealing to a sensibility. We're not appealing to an age group. We're not appealing to a sex. We're not appealing to how much education, how much wealth you have, or where you come from. It's a certain sensibility. It's not unlike what I used to see at Studio 54. I would see some young guy dance a pair of jeans with a shirt off, dancing with a woman in a ball gown and head to toe in diamonds. What connected them was the kind of sensibility, this pursuit of having fun. We're still after that with the nightclub, but it's kind of self-operative. You know, you throw something out there and people gravitate towards it of a certain sensibility. And it's not for everyone. I think that's its strength. And that's always been our approach. It was then and it still is now.
How easy is it for you to walk around the block in New York? Not in terms of being well known, but I mean, is your mind always ticking over, thinking, oh, there's a penthouse up there, I'm sure there is. We could do that with it, this, we could da-da-da-da. How restful is it being in Schrager, walking around a city full of opportunity? It must be a nightmare.
Well, some say it's a gift.
Right.
I say it's a curse because, you know, I'm like a sponge. I absorb things and I'm lucky that I can see things that other people perhaps can't see, and I can connect the dot with those things, and I could see some things that mean something to me that might not mean something to somebody else. It's never something literal. I never see something and say, you know, I want to do that. I see something, and I make an interpretation, a leap, that that's what that means. And then I try and, you know, do something that's kind of predicated on that.
How often do you go around and kick the tires on your own properties, you know, like check out how well everything's going? Do you have to be like a mystery shopper in your own hotels?
No, I kind of like the idea when I walk in and everyone stands, knows I'm here, and it keeps everybody on their toes. But more important, it lets everybody know how much I care about how the place is and how it's working. It's kind of a personal reflection upon me. And it's like, I feel like I'm inviting somebody into my own home. And my parents taught me when someone's in your own home, you treat them like royalty. You treat them, they can do no wrong. And so that's kind of the same basic fundamental approach I have, you know, with the hotels. You know, it's kind of funny. I can't tell you why I've been lucky enough to be successful with the hotels. If I could, I'd write a book about it. I can't. I start out, I don't know where I'm going to wind up. But it's an exciting trip, and I just put everything into it, And again, I'm trying to get to that place where the spark happens. And that's when I know it's ready. And when the people working in the hotel see how much I care about it, it's contagious because it lets them know that they should care about it as much as I do, because that really does translate with the guests.
And that's interesting. That's an important thing, I guess. It's people allowing to have some proximity to you and knowing where the brand comes from, knowing where the idea of all of these things comes from the top down. Is that something that you, you know, as a boss, you kind of want to propagate this thing of people getting it?
That people get it. You know what happens? I mean, when we started out at Studio 54, there were a number of people that came there and took our jobs, like telephone receptionist, security guard, bartender. They've gone on to become big stars in their field. And what I found was when you do something exciting, young people find a way of gravitating towards it. And it's just like a magnet attracting metal. And so you know, the people come to it. I think the people that we're looking for, that people who kind of understand and get what we're trying to do without me having to sit down with a brand book and explain it to them. Yeah. You know, they either get it or they don't. And that's the people we're looking for, you know, when we do a hotel and we try and staff it up with people.
And that's the thing. I mean, we talked about the mix of guests, but, you know, obviously the mix of staff is one of those all-time imponderables. It's always tough, and it's quite a fluid business, I suppose, as well. You know, people coming and going and moving and jumping ship and all the rest of it. How hands-on with that are you? I mean, is that because it's that thing of back in the day, picking the right doorman or the right bar person. You know, these are the people that represent you, aren't they, I suppose?
Well, I used to hire every single person that worked in a hotel, from doorman, bellman, housekeeper, every single person. And we used to have, talent calls, and sometimes the young people would be lined up around the block, you know, waiting to get a job. And we'd mark people in, four or five people at a time, and interview them and look at their responses. It was a kind of a fun process, and you're kind of making a spontaneous decision. Sometimes it's right, by the way, and sometimes it's wrong. But you know what's changed in the business over the last several years? When I first got started, there was nothing else available in the industry. We were the only one that was doing anything innovative. And so my focus was on the innovation and the visuals and not on the service. It's not that service wasn't important to me. It's just that I was trying to do something innovative. And perhaps our service wasn't as good as it should have been because it wasn't a priority of mine. It's not that it didn't matter to me. It's just I wanted to do something really cool and really innovative. So then we jump 20, 25 years later where there are other people that are doing it. The same kind of thing that we started. I like to think nobody's doing it as good. But I think that now people won't tolerate staying in a really visually spectacular hotel unless they also get the best service as well. So it's like, you know, our mantra is you don't have to sacrifice anything to stay in the coolest place in town. And I think that's one thing that changed so that now, you know, the visuals and the great food and beverage and the entertainment and everything which people have come to expect from me. But now service is the most important thing. So it's been a complete about face.
But the buildings still look pretty good. The interior still look
well,
pretty
I couldn't.
Good.
If it wasn't something great, I couldn't do it. It has to be something sexy. It has to be something that I look at and I can feel I could make into something special.
And what were the benchmarks for you before you embarked on the hotels project, but when you were between the clubs and the hotels and that time, what were the benchmarks for you? Where in the world did you love to go? What hotels did you love to stay in? What restaurant had the best maitre d' that you wanted to steal away to one of your places? What are your benchmarks?
Well, you know, in this country, you know, I think that Keith McNally is one of the best restaurateurs. Mm-hmm. You know, I've always loved his places. You know, he's done things a little bit differently than I. I mean, I think with Keith, he's kind of taken the French brasserie, but somehow, even though it's founded on being a French brasserie, and somehow he's made it his. And I've always thought he was great, and I think everything that he's always done is great. You know, I like Danny Meyer's restaurants here in this country. They're a little bit different than Keith's. The food is great, the service is great, but it doesn't quite have that snap to me that Keith McNally's restaurants do. You'd be surprised at the kind of hotels in the world that I think are great. I choose them not because of the way they look, but because of the way they make me feel. And in London, I like Claridge's. And Conrad, I have to get past some of the stiffness sometimes and the formality.
But to borrow a top hat, right?
Exactly, or you have to wear a tie.
Yeah.
in the lobby, which makes no sense to me, but, you know, everybody working there gives off this vibration that they're working in a special place. And that translates to people staying, you know, there. You know, I also like a small little charming place called the Covent Garden Hotel. It's kind of like 60 or 70 rooms. It looks very traditionally English, but it just, you know, I just really love it. I just feel, you know, very much at home. And I feel when I'm there, I'm staying in London. Mm-hmm. You know, I wouldn't want to stay in a hotel when I'm in London and feel not like I'm in London. I want to feel like I'm in London. I like the Okura in Tokyo, because it's a very smart hotel. Everything has been figured out. Haven't been there in quite some time, so that might have changed. I also like the Bel Air in L.A. The swans in the lake were a little much for me when you first walk in, but it feels like a quintessential Beverly Hills, Hollywood, movie star kind of place. And so when I'm visiting L.A., I like to stay there because it makes me feel like that. So I react to a hotel not just the way it looks, which I don't think is as important as the way it makes you feel.
That's an interesting place. And you're obviously very interested. You're very passionate about hotels that sit in a certain city, having the roots of that city, having the DNA is part of the city, I suppose. They're indistinguishable from the place they're in. That's very important. Yeah.
You know, it's always about how something makes you feel. You know, the visual part of it is important because it's the thing that hits your eyesight first. But you have to stimulate every one of the senses. And at the end of the day, it's how it makes you feel rather than how the hotel looks. And it's difficult to be focusing on trying to do something that makes you feel good because there's no map. You have to kind of, it's like making a boule base. You have to kind of put all the right elements in there and hope at the end it tastes right. And that's why it's such an exciting process for me and why I still love it.
You obviously, during running the nightclubs, you hung out with these amazing people. You went on to work with Julian Schnabel at the Gramercy. Were you always going to go into hotels? Did you ever want to manage a band? Did you ever want to do something else? How natural was that process from Studio 54 and the Palladium to your first hotel?
It's funny, people always ask me that. It was quite natural because Studio 54, at the end of the day, if you break it down, is a hospitality business. You know, your goal there is looking after your guests and making sure that they have a good time. Well, that's the same goal in a hotel business, except in one, people are invited to sleep over, and in the other one, people do sleep over, even though they shouldn't. But I think the goal is looking after your guests. I think hospitality businesses, whether they're restaurants, hotels, nightclubs, they all have the same goal in mind. So to that extent, to me, it was a logical progression, moving from Studio 54 and into a hotel. Hotel's a lot more civilized business. A lot of the kids working for me in a nightclub look like vampires during the day when I would, you know, ask them to work in a hotel. So it's a more civilized, it's a more complex business, where a nightclub is really a young person's business, seat-of-the-pants kind of operations, no rules. You know, you hold on for dear life if you happen to open up on that, a great big success. But people ask me, as you have, you know, would I have done anything else? And I think, yes, I suppose I could have been an architect, perhaps, or I could have been a movie director or a movie producer, you know, putting things together, putting this part of the element together and hoping that the total is more than the sum of all the individual parts. So, you know, I guess I could see that. I could never see myself working 9 to 5 and wearing a gray flannel suit. I couldn't see myself doing that, no matter how much money was involved.
Thank God for that. I wanted to, you mentioned architecture there, and it'd be nice to ask you about some of the residential things you're doing at the moment, working with Herzog & de Meuron, as you have done before, and John Pawson. What sort of collaborator are you with these people? Are you an easy guy to get on with when you're setting out your terms? Because there's lots of big names involved. How does that chess game work out?
I form like lifelong friendships with the people that I work with, because I'm really only interested in one thing, and that's the success of the project. I want it to be as good as it can possibly be. And I think when you feel that way, passionate, nothing else matters. The only thing that matters is the product. And when you feel like that, it's contagious. Everybody feels like that. And I've had times on occasion where issues of credit come up, not with the main people I'm collaborating with, but certain of the other people on the periphery. And it's like a high tide. If this place is successful, everyone will benefit. If it's not successful, you can take all the credit for it. And I'm kind of thinking that they have faith in me after we work for a while, that all I care about is creating the best product available and getting the best work imaginable out of the people that I'm working with. And I'm relentless about it, but I'm, you know, doing it not with an iron fist. I'm doing it with a velvet glove with dynamite inside them. You know, I'm trying to get them to produce their best possible work. But at the end of the day, everybody's gratified by it because they're quite pleased, you know, with the process. So I'm kind of like, you know, my role is like a mom, a dad, a sister, a brother, a coach, school teacher, whatever it is I have to do to get this person to do the best possible work. And I like to think that the work they're doing with me, if somebody else hired them, it wouldn't be as good. Because, again, it's the alchemy that happens. It's I think a lot of the great designers and architects and will tell you that what makes a great project is having a great client.
Yeah, right. And someone that knows what they want, but not absolutely.
And push.
Yeah.
And create a setting that allows that talented architect, designer, whatever, do the best thing that they can do. They get motivated. They get stimulated by it. And that's what my job is.
Can you remember the first great party you went to? Can you remember when you wanted to get into this whole game?
When I wanted to get into nightclub business, funny, I was practicing law.
Yeah.
And this was just when, you know, you drive around New York and people were waiting online, being abused, trying to get in nightclubs. It's like when they were really offering nothing that another nightclub down the block wasn't offering, but this nightclub was the hottest place in town or for whatever reason, and people were waiting online to get in there and pay the money. And I thought to myself, well, that kind of business that I have to get into. I love the nightclub business, but don't forget, when I went into it, it was a little bit like the beginnings of rock and roll and a little bit like the beginnings of the tech industry. It was like a garage business. It didn't take much money. There were not a lot of rules. You know, you just went into it. Now it's completely different. Like the music business, unlike the tech industry, it's not a young person's business. It's not created in the garage. I did my my first nightclub, you know, for $27,000. So I love being in the nightclub business because it's so undisciplined that I was able to be exposed to multiple disciplines: fashion, film, theater, music, etc. Where a lot of times you get started in businesses and you kind of pigeonholed right away and you get one specific focus about something rather than having this broad spectrum of exposure. I think you probably have that in the magazine business too, by the way. You know, and so that was a great thing for me because I got the taste of a lot of different things, and because I didn't really know anything when I got started. So it was like a real eye-opening experience.
And how difficult was it? Take Studio 54, for example. How difficult was it to keep the, not the eye on the prize, but to keep opening it every night? I mean, you know, there's a lot of high old times that happened under your stewardship, yours and Steve Rubell's stewardship therein. How easy was it to make sure you opened up every night?
Well, you know, it's funny, you know, in the nightclub business, in a funny kind of way, your product is magic because you have the same music, you have the same liquor that everybody else has. So without having that kind of product, like in a hotel, I have a bed I have to sell. You come into the city, irregardless of anything, if you need a bed, you know, you're going to want to stay in a hotel. So creating that magic every day, creating something from nothing every day, is nerve-wracking, and it's exhausting. And it's why a lot of the people in the business get consumed by it, because it just takes everything. It's like every day, the next day is a new day, a new start. You can't rely on what happened yesterday. You got to start all over again. And so it's a tough business to that extent. A lot of the people that go into the nightclub business like the people part of it, like Steve did. He loved, you know, being there at night and being the ringmaster, and he loved it. That wasn't the part that I loved. The part that I loved was creating these experiences and making people feel like they were in a special place for some unknown, unquantifiable reason. That was the part that I liked. That's why we're such perfect partners, because we both liked different aspects of it.
And I mean, there are so many moments from that period that are famous. There's a new photography book, I think, coming out, which is a Studio 54 book. There would be many others. Are there any moments? Was there one moment that kind of defines that part of your life and that nightclub?
I always used to like the Halloween parties the best. It's so funny. I think Studio 54's Halloween party had a lot to do with creating it as such a big event. This was before the Village Parade. And I think the Village Parade happened after. And I like to kind of think that what we experience now for Halloween, Studio had something to do. And the reason that I liked it was, first of all, everybody saw it as an opportunity to get in because everybody was wearing costumes. So we used to have the most outrageous costumes and the creativity from all the kids in the street. It was just unbelievable. And it's like your imagination was your own limitation by what you wanted to do, kind of creating that particular evening. We used to be inspired by Bosch. I remember one time we put like 3 tons of glitter on the floor, so you were in this kind of magical place, and people were finding glitter in their rugs 6 or 7 or 8 months, you know, after the event. There are lots of nights that are incredibly memorable for me. I remember, the first night was probably within the 4 or 5 days of us opening. Halston had called up and wanted to have a party for Bianca Jagger. And so, you know, we scurried about and, you know, we got a white horse and, you know, we got a woman to be naked like Lady Godiva, and we painted clothes on her, and we painted clothes on a nude man and who led the horse in, and where they were bringing in the birthday cake. And I remember when they, you know, presented the birthday cake, Lady Godiva character got off and presented it to Bianca, and Bianca jumped up on a horse and so on and so forth. And then when that was done, I went home. So then I get a call the next morning from Steve in the morning that we were on the cover of the New York Post. And it was such an exhilarating time for him and for me, because that was the lifeblood of the business. You know, being in the newspapers, that was the way, you know, we created a lot of traction. You know, imagine a nightclub was on the cover of the New York Post. And I think that was a memorable time for me. And I have many others as well.
And just to bring it back up to date, Ian, is there a little tableau that might have taken place in one of your hotels recently that's kind of reminded you of why you're in this business, that is a little picture of success to you?
You know, I remember one time when we were opening up, you know, Morgan's Hotel. That was the first hotel that we ever did. It was a utopian experience because there wasn't 1 inch of the space that I didn't contemplate and we didn't go over. You know, we were trying to reinvent the business, and Studio 54 was a hard act to follow. And so we didn't want Studio 54 to be the high point. You know, we were on a road. And so we were creating Morgan's, and one time I remember seeing Andy Warhol, you know, outside peeking in to kind of see what we were up to and, you know, and what we were doing. And it made me, you know, kind of realize that people were really interested in what we were trying to do here. They knew it wasn't going to be a traditional hotel. And so yeah, that was also, I think the memories we take with us going forward are those kind of seemingly insignificant things, but for some reason resonate with you. I think we all have those from our family life and all, and so that's another one of these things that I just remember.
Well, I think if Andy Warhol's nosing through a crack in the building site wall, then you know you're kind of, if not a success, and at least definitely very interesting, right?
Exactly.
Well, Ian Schrager, by his own admission, is not an iron fist. He's a velvet glove clutching a stick of dynamite. Ian Schrager, thank you very much for your time.
Pleasure. Thank you for having me.
You've been listening to The Big Interview with Ian Schrager talking to me, Robert Bounds, in New York City. That's it for this series, but tune in over the next couple of weeks to hear some of our highlights and listen out for a brand new season with the biggest names coming your way later this year on Monocle 24. For now, thanks for tuning in.